Okay, good evening. Our topic for tonight is I wanted to take a little bit of time, probably a shorter shiur than usual, but to take a little bit of time to explore some of the deeper meaning behind the tefillos that we say on Hanukkah. Last year, if you remember, again, we actually spent two sessions focusing on the tefillos of Hanukkah, where we focused a little bit more on Hallel, on Alanisim, on Bimei Matisyahu. But tonight, I'd like to specifically focus on the very interesting tefillos that we say at the time when we kindle the Hanukkah menorah, that we say at the time of Hadlakas Neiros. So if we take a look at number one, we're familiar with Haneiros Halalu. So let's just read it through for just a moment. Haneiros Halalu, these particular candles, Anachnu Madlikim, we light Ala Nisim, V'Ala Neflaos, V'Ala Chuos, V'Ala Nochamos, in commemoration of the miracles, the wonderments, the salvations, the wars, Sha'asisa Lavo, saying that you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, did for our forefathers, by Mimahim Bazman Azeh. In these days, in that time, Ayidei Kohanecha HaKidosh. And of course, the very unique aspect of the Hanukkah story is the idea that people who really were not skilled in warfare at all rose to the occasion and waged battle on behalf of the Jewish people. And all 8 days, these candles are holy. We have no right to use them, to derive benefit from them. The only thing we are permitted to do is simply to look, to gaze upon them. Why? Because of course, if you're going to use the actual candles, then it's not clear that the candles are being kindled for the sake of a mitzvah. It's quite possible that the reason you're kindling the candles is some kind of personal use. Therefore, we do not use them, we only gaze at them, and by abstaining from using the candles, kedei lahodos ulahala l'shim chagodol, we testify, essentially, or our actions indicate that the whole reason for kindling these candles is to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu al nisecha, v'al niflosecha, v'al yeshua secha. For again, the miracles that God performs for us, the niflos, the wondrous events, v'al yeshua secha, and for the salvations. So what I'd like to spend a couple of moments on is to try to see where did this particular tefillah come from. Now, what's unique about this? Well, let's see. Number two. So, interestingly enough, this tefillah of Haneiros Halalu, I'm calling it tefillah, although you'll see we might have to change our phraseology in just a little bit, but this tefillah comes from the Gemara. Here I'm quoting to you from Maseches Sofrim. We know that in the Gemara there are what we'll call primary tractates and secondary tractates. It's not that one is more important than the other, it's just that some of the secondary tractates are a little bit smaller. So for example, Maseches Sofrim, which has many of the details of the halachos of tefillin, of Sefer Torah, of mezuzos, happens to have a lot of assorted halacha as well. So in the middle of Maseches Sofrim, the Gemara says the following, number two, Ketzad Mevarchin. How do you go ahead and how do you make the brachos on the Ner Chanukah? Beyom HaRishon HaMadlik Mevarich Shalosh. On the first night of Chanukah, we spoke about this a little bit last week, the one who is kindling the menorah makes 3 brachos. HaMadlik Omer, what's the bracha? Baruch HaTa Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kiddushanu BeMitzvosav V'Tzivanu LaHadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. So the first bracha, LaHadlik Ner, right? The bracha is over the kindling of the Chanukah light. Umasneva Omer, and after reciting that bracha, writes the Gemara, what do you do? The word masne means what? Right? So good, good. We'll come to that definition. Simpler definition. From Lashon of Tnai. You stipulate. You stipulate and you say, Haneiros Halalu, Haneiros Ha'ilu, Anu Madligin. These candles that we have lit, Ali Yeshuos, V'ala Nisim, V'ala Niflos, on the salvations, on the miracles of the wondrous deeds, Asher Asisa Lavasim, that you, God, did for our forefathers, Al Yidei Kohanecha Kedoshim, through your holy Kohanim, V'choshmona Simei Chanukah, Haneiros Ha'ilu Kodesh, and all for all 8 days these candles are holy, V'einlan Rishus L'shtamish Bohem, Elo Lirosan Bilvad. And we have no right to use them, rather only to gaze upon them, Kedei Lohodos Shimcha, in order that we could give thanks to your name for all of your wondrous deeds, all of your miracles, and all of your salvations. Then the Gemara goes on, Va'omer, Baruch Atah Shechianu, Va'omer Baruch Ata Sha'asa Nisim. So a couple of very intriguing pieces of this Gemara. Number one, which is the third lesson, which is the order of the brachos. Interestingly enough, what's the order of the Gemara as? Number one, Lahadlik. Number two, Shechyanu. And number three, Sha'asa Nisim. Okay, so we're not going to get too much into that tonight. But of course, what is most gripping about this Gemara? Right? Interestingly enough, the way the Gemara has this set up is Haneros Halalu is said immediately after the first bracha. Now, the Gemara leaves out one piece of information, which is missing. I can't expect you to know, right? The question is, according to the Gemara, when are you actually lighting the ner? When are you actually lighting the candle itself? Are you lighting the candle at the end of all of these brachos? In which case, by the way, that's a pretty long unit there. You have Lahadlik Ner, Haneros Halalu, Sha'asanis, or Shechianu Sha'asanisim. Or are you kindling it at the end of all the brachos? Or are you kindling it immediately after the bracha of Lahadlik Ner? So if you skip down for just one moment to number three, see here I quoted you from the Sefer Abu Draham. And you have a little biography there as well. So the Abu Draham writes, "Va'amrinan b'mesecha sofrim, hamadlik ner Chanukah, acher shehidlik, omer haneros halalu." So the Abu Draham understands that, in fact, what the Gemara is saying is the following: that when we come to light our menorah, the first thing we do is we say the bracha of lahadlik ner shel Chanukah. Then what do we do immediately afterwards? You light the candle or candles. And then, after you light the candles, what do you say? Haneros Halalu. And then after reciting Haneros Halalu, you go ahead and you finish up making the other brachos of Sha'asa Nisim, and on night number one, Shechyanu. So why is this Gemara important? Because it creates a framework for Haneros Halalu. So now if I were to ask you, what is the point of the tefillah, or the recitation of Haneros Halalu, what would you say? What's its goal? You've been saying it for six nights. Okay, it could explain why you're lighting the candles. Okay.
It's an elevation of the visible.
Okay, even simpler. It's a reminder about what? Good. Who said that? That you can't use the candles. So it would appear that the way the Gemara structures it is that immediately after kindling the menorah, the lighter very quickly reminds himself and perhaps the family gathered around him or the individuals gathered around him that we are not lighting this for illumination. So there is an immediate reminder right after the kindling of the Ein Lanu Rishus Lehishtamesh Bahem. We must be careful not to use these candles. And then, of course, the rest of the tefillah explains to us why we may not use it. Because the candles themselves are there as a testament to the wondrous act of the Ribono Shalom. So in its purest form, Haneros Halalu was not really it's a nice song. Haneros Halalu was not created as a nice song to sing about the miracle of Chanukah. But Haneros Halalu was a recitation that originally was placed right after the kindling of the Neros Chanukah to remind those who are standing by the menorah do not receive any benefit from these candles because these are Neros Mitzvah. It's also interesting to note the Gemara's usage of the word umasna, and you stipulate, right? It almost is as if that what the lighter is doing is essentially saying, I'm lighting these candles on the condition not to receive benefits from them. So that in the event that someone does receive benefit from them, then what? It's as if it did not occur, so to speak, right? Meaning what the kindler is essentially saying is, please understand, my intent from the beginning is not to derive any level of benefit from these candles, so if it does happen that I accidentally derive benefit from it, it should not be counted as benefit. So we see that from the beginning, Haneros Halalu is a very utilitarian shira. You see now I'm hesitant to even call it a song, because Bipashas, it wasn't created as a song. It was actually created more as a reminder / disclaimer. Right? We've turned it into a song. But in its initial form, Haneros Halalu was created in order to ensure that the lighter and those around the menorah would not derive benefits from the candles. And if they were to derive benefit accidentally, they are already, so to speak, swearing off benefit from the beginning of the Hadlaka. If you take a look at number 4, so the Shulchan Aruch writes, our minhag, after shehidlik, after you kindle the menorah. Now remember, we do it a little bit differently than is brought down in the Gemara. We go ahead and we only kindle the menorah after all of the brachos are made. So after shehidlik, Omer haneros halalu anu madlikin ala teshuos v'al hanisim v'al haniflos. So therefore, says the Shulchan Aruch, right after we make our brachos, 3 on the first night, 2 on the subsequent nights, we begin to say haneros halalu. Interestingly enough, if you look at the Mishnah Berurah number 5, the Mishnah Berurah writes, when do you begin to say Haneros Halalu? Acher Shehidlik Ner Harishon. This is fascinating. When do you begin to say Haneros Halalu? After when? After your first light. So you ever wonder about that? Why do we begin to say Haneros Halalu immediately after the first candle? Why not wait until they're all lit? But now it makes a lot of sense. Why? Why would you do it immediately after the first candle? Oh, because if the whole essence of Haneros Halalu is to remind me that I should not get benefits from the Neros, so it makes sense that as soon as a Ner begins to give off light, I recite the recitation that reminds me not to derive benefit. Before you light. I guess because it's considered to be a little bit more potent. When the candle has now been kindled and you are actively reminding yourself in the face of the light not to derive benefits from the light. So I think, yes?
How does it work to say I'm not getting benefit? You know, I just found my pictures by the light of the menorah, but I didn't get any benefit. But you did.
Right. So I think more what it's saying is that my intent is not to derive benefit. I'm making a declaration that I really don't want to derive benefit from these candles, and if I do, it's accidental and incidental. Obviously, if a person bekavana goes over to the Neros Chanukah and uses their light, okay, that's in violation. But it's almost like saying that even if by accident I do get benefit, please understand now that I am swearing off that benefit from the beginning. So yes.
Also, if you would light it, if you would say Haneros Halalu before you light the candles,
well, it wouldn't be a hefsek if you said it before the bracha. What Chana is saying is, say it first thing.
It says to start singing when you light the first candle.
I'm sorry. Oh, true. Although one could make the argument that it wouldn't be called an interruption, because an interruption is only saying that it's extraneous to the matter at hand. You know, the classic example is it's a scene that repeats itself at many a Shabbos table, right? Everybody washes, sit down for hamotzi, and what happens? Someone forgot to put the challah knife on there, or the salt, right? So it begins the game of charades, right? No one knows what you're talking about. So the Mishnah Berurah says quite explicitly, you're allowed to say knife, you're allowed to say salt. Mishnah Berurah says if you could say it Balashon HaKodesh, if you could say it in Hebrew, right? Sakin, melach, that's a little bit better. Why? Because it's not called a hefsek. A hefsek is something that's totally extraneous to the activity at hand. So I think even if you were to go ahead and say Haneros Halalu after Lahadlik Ner before, it still wouldn't be called a hefsek. But I think the point that the Mishnah Berurah is trying to highlight over here is that although we don't accept the Gemara's model in the purest form, in that we're not doing Lahadlik light and then Haneros Halalu, we're going to say all the brachos light, but we will begin to say Haneros Halalu immediately after the kindling of the first candle, because Haneros Halalu is the reminder, don't get benefit from these candles. What? Yes? Benefit means deriving any level of enjoyment, benefit, use from the candles. But it has to be real use. Meaning, I think everybody enjoys standing by the Hanukkah candles. That's not the use we're talking about. We mean a more utilitarian use. Like you know, you want to create the Hanukkah ambiance, so you shut the lights in the room, and the only source of illumination in the room is the Hanukkah candles. That's problematic. So what's interesting to note is, if we look at this particular tefillah, we are essentially thanking Hashem for 3 major things. Nisim, Niflaos, and Teshuos. Now, out of those three things, probably the easiest one to define is Teshuos. What's a Teshua? A salvation, which can be easily defined as being saved from an enemy. So on Hanukkah, we note the fact that we were in mortal danger. It didn't originally start this way, but then later on it became a mortal danger at the hands of the Greeks, and the Ribono Shel Olam provided us with the Yeshua, provided us with a salvation that saved us from a physical threat. What about Nisim and Niflos? So if you take a look at number 6, Rav Hirsch, in his commentary on the Siddur, gives two very interesting insights. He says the expression Niflos describes these extraordinary occurrences in terms of their independence from the regular order of things. So according to Rav Hirsch, Niflaos means things or activities or events, happenings that are clearly above the plane of normal existence. Again, independence from the regular order of things. That, of course, most overtly describes the Nes of the Pach Shemen. Right, the nace of the one jug of oil, which was a miracle that occurred, which was so beyond. You know, the difference between the military victory and the Pach Shemen is the military victory at least was cloaked in Teva. It was cloaked in nature. Meaning it's not the pshat that the Jews stood there with their hands by their side and the Greeks fell dead around them. They had to get an army. They had to go to war. They had to fight. They had to incur losses. So although it was nothing short of miraculous, it's cloaked in Teva. As opposed to the Nes of the Pach Shemen, the miracle of the cruse of oil, which was really a pala, which was really a nifla. That was niflos. There was no way to logically, rationally, physically define, or not define is the wrong word, but explain that particular miracle. That's a niflos, says Rav Hirsch. What about Nisim? If you take a look at 6b, he says something fascinating. He says, Nisim denote the great acts of God. And here Rav Hirsch has such an amazing chiddush, describing them as signposts and symbols that stand out as standards or banners to teach and to guide us. So this is fascinating. According to Rav Hirsch, a nes doesn't just mean a miracle. A nes almost means like a sign, a symbol, a standard, a banner, something that you are to look at, and when you look at that nes, you glean some type of understanding. It's actually quite interesting, because if you take a look at number 7, we see this usage of the word nes, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Asei lecha saraf, v'sim oso al nes. If you remember again, this is talking about the episode in the desert where there was an outbreak of serpents. Serpents is the English word. It's poisonous snakes. Poisonous snakes. Am Yisrael was complaining again against that at the Ribono Shel Olam, and there was this outbreak of snakes. After which Baruch Hu tells Moshe, "You want to heal the people? Here's what you have to do. What later on comes to be called the Nechushtan. You go ahead and you're going to fashion a copper snake, and you're going to wrap it around what? Al Nes. Nes in this context is what? Is a staff. Is a staff. V'haya kol hanashuch." Now this staff was very tall, so what would happen? Whoever looked up at the staff, ultimately again, would be healed. Now of course Rashi points out, it wasn't the staff itself didn't have restorative powers, but again, it's the staff made you look up, and making you look up caused you to gaze heavenward. Causing you to gaze heavenward ultimately is a way of allowing man to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We see, just as an aside, we see this theme very often in Judaism, that Judaism recognizes that spirituality must be accomplished in steps. You cannot go ahead and just, boom, forge a meaningful relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. The classical example of this is Tcheles. We know there's a mitzvah to go ahead and have a blue string on the tzitzis. So why? So the Gemara Menachos says, Tcheles do melayam. Right, Tcheles resembles the sea. Yam domel rakia. The sea resembles the sky. Rakia domel kisei hakavod, and it is the sky that resembles God's throne of glory. So why don't you just tell me that the blue of the Tcheles resembles what? The throne of Hashem and Shalom Yisrael. So you see, because spirituality is a step process. You have to begin first with recognizing the expansiveness of the seas. Then when you recognize the expansiveness of the seas, go and recognize the expansiveness of the heavens. And then when you see the heavens, which is just a little bit of the Ribono Shel Olam, you could come to appreciate the throne of glory itself. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes in and builds this Nechushtan so that the people could at least begin to direct their eyes heavenward. The reason why this is important for us is because we see the word Nes now not just referring simply to a staff, but this is also like a sign, something that people are to look to. Therefore, says Rav Hirsch, Nisim is much more than miracles. Nisim ultimately are miracles that carry with them some type of eternal message. A miracle that man is to look to for some level of eternal understanding. Therefore, using Rav Hirsch's definition, we could suggest then, or Rav Hirsch really is suggesting, that somehow Neros Chanukah are a nes. Not miracle nes, they are a miracle nes, but Neros Chanukah is some type of, to borrow Rav Hirsch, standard, banner, signpost that man is to look to, because somehow Neros Chanukah contains some type of relevant eternal message. The question that we're going to try to deal with a little bit tonight is, what is this eternal message of Neros Chanukah? See, interestingly enough, I think to come to answer this question, we have to look at the next tefillah, which is Maos Tzor. So a little bit about Maos Tzor. So first of all, you should know, it's only Ashkenazim who sing Maos Tzor. Sfardim and many others, not just Sfardim, don't sing Maos Tzor. Well, let me say it differently. If Sfardim want to sing Maos Tzor, they can. We have it like corner of the market on it. But interestingly enough, the Shulchan Aruch does not bring down Maos Tzor. Although you just saw before, he does bring down Haneros Halalu, he does not bring down Maos Tzor. Okay, Maos Tzor was composed somewhere around 1250 Common Era. Now, just to give you the time frame, Hanukkah occurs approximately when? About 150 BCE. So Maos Tzor is created, and we'll discuss by who, is created, figure, about 1400 years after the Hanukkah story. Now, there is a lot of mystery surrounding who composed Maos Tzor. There's one thing we know, is that the poet's name was Mordechai. How do we know that his name was Mordechai? Because Maos Tzor is an acrostic. In fact, if you just want to run through it very quickly, if you look, you have Maos Tzor, Mem, Ra'osava, Reish, Devir Kadsho, Dalid. All right, you get the point. Kros Kamas, Chaf, and Yevanim. Yevanim Nekutsu. We'll talk about the last one afterwards. Right? So now you have, according to many opinions, the composer of this particular song was a man by the name of Mordechai. Some say his name was Mordechai Ben Yitzchak. Some say his name was Mordechai Ben Yitzchak Chazak, which we'll speak about a little bit as well. Now, what's interesting to note is the makeup of Maos Tzor. Let's spend a couple of moments just going through the stanza, because you'll see something really fascinating that develops. So we begin, of course, in number 8. So we say, Maos Tzor Yeshuasi, Lechana El Shabech. This one we're going to read the whole thing. So, Almighty Rock of my salvation, to praise you is a delight. Tikon Beis Tefilasi, restore my house of prayer, and there we will bring a thanksgiving offering. When you have prepared the slaughter for the blaspheming foe, Az Egmor Beshir Mizmor Chanukas HaMizbech. Then I shall complete with a song of hymn, the dedication of the altar. The theme of this first paragraph, if you look in 8 Aleph, this is from the Sefer Nesiv Bina, I've quoted it before, Rav Yaakovson, almost like an encyclopedia on all tefillos. So Rav Yaakovson writes, Habayis Harishon, this first paragraph, Midaber Al HaGi'ula. The order, as we're going to see, is quite intriguing. The first paragraph speaks about messianic redemption. Al Chanukah Sabayis Lo'osid Lovo. It speaks about the dedication of the temple in the future. So Maos Tzor begins with a very strong messianic theme. Az Egmor Bashir Mizmor. The song has yet to be completed. When will the real song be completed? Chanukah HaMizbeach. when the Ribbono Shel Olam, when you allow us to rededicate our altar in the third Beis HaMikdash, then the song that has been sung for thousands of years will finally come to a close. Look at stanza number 2. And now we begin to see a theme. Ra'os sava nafshi b'yogon kochi kila. So now the theme becomes a little bit more about the suffering of the Jewish people. Trouble saved my soul when with grief my strength was consumed. Chayai meru b'koshi. They made my life very difficult with backbreaking labor. B'shibud malchus egla. So how does it end? Chel paron v'chol zaro yardu ki even b'mtzula. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you went ahead and you took us out of this bondage. Pharaoh's army and all of his offspring went down like a stone into the deep. So what does this refer to? Mitzrayim, Egyptian bondage and redemption. Egyptian bondage and redemption. Now look at stanza 3. Devir kot shoha aviani. Good news, Ribbono Shel Olam, you brought us to the abode of His Holiness. We're fast-forwarding in Jewish history. If stanza 2 spoke about the Egyptian bondage and redemption, the next step is talking about Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. The Ribbono Shel Olam allowed us to build the Beis HaMikdash, but the gam sham lo shakatati. But even there, I did not find rest. Why? Because uvano geis v'higloni. Because even though I was in my land, I was then exiled. Why? Kizarim avarati. Because I worshipped idolatry. So he skips a little bit. Kates bavel, zeru bavel, lekates shivim noshati. When at Babylonia's demise, zeru bavel came, at the end of 70 years, I was saved. So what does stanza 3 talk about? Right? Destruction of the first temple, exile, and redemption from exile. So the entire Babylonian experience from beginning to end, destruction, exile, redemption, is stanza number 3. So you already begin to see the theme of Ma'osur. Ma'osur is going to be for us a timeline of Jewish history. So in stanza 2 we spoke about the Egyptian experience. In stanza number 3 we speak about first temple Babylonian experience. Now we come to stanza 4. Kros komas birosh, to sever the towering cypress. Bikesh Agogi ben Hamdasa. Who is Agogi ben Hamdasa? Haman. Haman. Rosh Yemini Nisesa, but you elevated the Yemini. Who is the Yemini? Right? Mordechai. Remember how is Mordechai identified in the Megillah? Ish Yehudi, right? Ish Yehudi, Yah Bishush Nabir Shmor Mordechai. Ben Yerai, Ben Yerai Bishem Vikish, Ish Yemini. Right, so you, even though Haman came to cut down, what was it, the towering cypress? Rosh Yemini Nisesa. You lifted up the head of the Yemini, of Mordechai. V'oyev Shmo Machisa. And you allowed the enemy's name to be blotted out. Rov Banav V'kinyanav Al Ha'etz Talisa. His numerous progeny, all of his children, his 10 sons, his possessions, on the gallows you hanged. So now, what have we done? So interestingly enough, remember, as much as stanza number 3... right, really seems to put like a close to the Jewish existence outside the land of Israel. Remember, Purim is still in there as well. So look at the timeline so far. We have Hanukkah. We have destruction, exile, redemption from First Temple, from Babylonian experience. Stanza 4, we now have Purim. What happens in number 5? Yevan and Nikbetzu Alai. So number 5, we finally get to what? Hanukkah. Azai bimei chashmonim, chashmonim, ufartzu chomos migdalai v'timu kol hashmonim. So stanza number 5, that one is probably the most self-explanatory out of all of them. In stanza number 5, we refer to the incredible miracle of Hanukkah. Now we come to stanza number 6. Chasuf zeroa kodshecha v'karif keitz ha-yeshua. Literally, bear your holy arm and hasten the end for salvation. By the way, what is that? What is that image of God bearing His arm? I'm sorry? Not tefillin. Although that is an image that's used sometimes. You know the expression of rolling up your sleeves? Right? That's chasov surah kachach. Get to work. so to speak, right? Come on, when are you going to roll up your sleeves? And when are you going to go ahead and redeem us? Chasov sura kachicha, v'karif keit ha-yeshua. This is a very dramatic stanza. And bring an end for the salvation. Nikom nikmas dam avadecha, me'u ma harisha. And avenge the vengeance of your servant's blood from the wicked nation. Which wicked nation is he referring to? Who? Right, remember, there's no Romans anymore in 1250. Right, but he's referring to the offspring of the Romans. Who ultimately inherited the Roman Empire? Christianity. Hold on to that for just a little bit. So, oh, excellent. Hold on to that for 1 second. Avenge the vengeance of your servants, but from the wicked nation. Listen to this desperate plea. Ki archad lanu ha-yeshua. For the triumph is too long delayed for us. So look, something amazing has just happened. We begin Ma'osur with an incredible yearning for Geula, but a positive yearning for Geula. We then speak about all the redemption. Redemption from Egypt. Redemption from Babel. Redemption of Purim. Redemption of Hanukkah. And now, it's almost like Mordechai, the composer, brings us to the current predicament. Ribono shel olam. We are suffering too much. Life is just too difficult. Ki archal lanu ha-yeshua. We've waited too long for redemption. The ein keitz li me'harah. Listen to the depth of those words. There is no end to the days of evil. Dechei admon betzel tzalmon. Repel the red one. Right? The red one, of course, Edom. But Edom, of course, remember, is the father of Greece, the father of Rome, and ultimately the father of Christianity. Betzel tzalmon. In the nethermost shadow, hakem lanu roim shiva. And bring us our seven shepherds. Who are the seven shepherds? So the Gemara Masechet Sukkim number 9 quotes the prophetic vision of Micha, of the Navi Micha. So the Navi Micha says, if you skip to the last line there, in number 9, he says, David Be'emtza, this is a shir in and of itself. King David is in the middle. This is talking about the line of great people that will emerge in the Messianic era. King David is in the middle. Adam Sheis u'mishu selach mi'emino. So Adam Sheis, the son of Noah, and Mishu Selach on the right of David HaMelech, Avraham, Yaakov, u'Moshe bismolo. And Avram, Yaakov, and Moshe are going to be on the left of King David. Interestingly enough, in this vision, it's not just Jews, but it's Jew and, so to speak, Gentile alike. This represents the seven shepherds, represent the role models for all humanity, not just for the Jews. Because remember, the Messianic era represents a refinement of mankind, not just the refinement of Am Yisrael. See, here at the end, this Mordechai begs HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Dechei Admon Betzel Tzalmon, get rid of Edom, v'hakem lanu roim shiva. Let us see the prophetic vision of Micha when the seven shepherds, when the Messianic era is ushered in. If you take a look at number 10, I'm sorry? What are they? Yes, so that's the seven we just named. David, Adam, Sheis, Mishu, Selach, Avram, Yaakov, Moshe. So if you look at number 10, the Nesiv Bina points out something very interesting. He says, if you look by the bracket, he says, Habayis ha'acharon medaber gamkein al ha'geulah. See, interestingly enough, what comes out from the structure of Moshe, it's just amazing. I have to say, how a tefillah that we could sing for years and years on end, but we totally, no, I shouldn't say you. I was a little embarrassed that this is like the first year that I actually understood Ma'osur. But the profundity is so incredible. So here what you have just in Mordechai's structures, you have bookends. You have the first stanza that talks about Messianic redemption, and the last stanza that talks about Messianic redemption, but the tones are radically different. In stanza number 1, the tone is quite hopeful. In stanza number 2, the tone is hopeful, but the tone is nevertheless kind of sprinkled with incredible feelings of desperation, feeling forlorn, and almost a little bit of a tinge of wanting to give up. So Nesiv Bina writes, Abayis Achron Gamkein, Midaber Gamkein Al Gula. The last paragraph also speaks about redemption. But it's very different in the text and in the layout of the first paragraph. You see, there are two different ways in which Jews ask for redemption. What are the two ways, the two avenues to redemption? Either A, life is great, but what? I want it to be even better. That's possibility one. Possibility two is, life is terrible, and I need you, God, to make it better. So the request is the same, of bringing the geula, but the catalyst for the requests are radically different. One comes, I once heard a beautiful, beautiful talk by Rabbi Lau, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, where he pointed out that the Navi refers to Am Yisrael in two different ways. The Navi refers to us as doves, and the Navi refers to us as clouds. So Rav Lau said very beautifully, he said, what's there between doves and clouds? He says, doves take flight on their own. Clouds are pushed by wind. So Rav Lau said, there are two ways that Jews seek out Geula. They spread their wings and they actively try to find it, or they wait until the winds of life force themselves upon the clouds and push them to move. So that's really what's being reflected over here. In paragraph number one, there is a desire for geula, but it's a proactive desire. There is no tinge of suffering there. It's everything could be fine, but even if everything is great, I still want something more. Stanza six is life has simply become unbearable. And if God, if you don't do something soon, I don't know how I could go on like this. She goes on, Kiat Tlaos Merubos. Because in stanza six, Mordechai teaches us that there's too much suffering. Ukvar machkim la'avdan ha'oyev ulechidush yameinu kikadem. The enemy is wiser and stronger than us, and now we're already plotting our annihilation. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu, what we need you to do is to restore our days like the days of old. Now, what's interesting to note is, and as was mentioned before, it's really this last paragraph that gives us the historical context for when this Mordechai is living. Remember that during 1250, is still the Crusades are happening, which means that Jews, there's wholesale murder in Jewish communities. It's also, interestingly enough, Dafka, the year 1250, is when the Inquisition begins the use of torture. You know, we when we think about the Inquisition wasn't always involved in torture. The Inquisition was always trying to get people to convert, but they were hoping that people would do it willingly. 1250 represented a dramatic shift in the church's stance, that they began torturing people for the purpose of converting. Now, there's not enough historical information to know where this Mordechai was from, right? Is he in Spain? Is he in France? But the truth is, in Europe, at this point in time, Jewish blood is spilling pretty freely. So again, we have the pogroms going on. We have the Inquisition using torture methods. Interestingly enough, a couple of years before this, somewhere between 1245 and 1248, is the public burning of 24 wagon loads of the Talmud in Paris. This was the Shulchan Aruch actually mentions this event, and actually mentions that people used to fast on this day. So this is an incredibly turbulent time. So again, we have Crusades, we have torture by the Inquisition, we have public burnings of the Gemara in Paris. So this Mordechai is saying in this Ma'ov Sor, Ribono Shel Olam, you have to get us out of this. Now here's what's interesting to note. If you look at number 11, so the Nesiv Bina again writes, he quotes the Sefer Otsar Shira HaIvrit, he writes, Piyut Lechanaka, Simon Mordechai Chazak Ben Yitzchak. So remember, we saw his name Mordechai, we saw his name Mordechai from the first five stanzas, but others say his name was Chazak. Where do they get Chazak from? HaSimon Chazak Yotze Min Abayis Chasof Zeroa Kodshecha. Okay, Shalafi Anira. Hi Ho Safa Mi'ucheres. So what the Nesipin of Rav Yaakovson points out, quoting this other source, is it would appear just historically that Hasof Zeroa Kodshecha was an add-on. It was not part of the original Ma'os Tzur. Now what's his proof to that? Mishum Shebahar Beis Sidurim Chasar HaBayis Hazeh. Interestingly enough, there were many earlier editions of the Siddur that did not have this last stanza of Ma'os Tzur. So apparently, or they are speculating that Chasof Zeroa Kodshecha was not originally part of the Ma'os Tzur. Or there's another possibility. It was part of Ma'os Tzur. But what happened? Aval Efshar Gam Shehishmituhu me'avas hashalom, mipnei acharuz, nikom nikmas dam avadecha, me'uma harisha'a shenintza'abo. Or he suggests another possibility, namely, it was part of the original ma'azur. I said, so why didn't it appear in certain sidurim? They took it out. They took it out. Why did they take it out? Because the truth is, this is, it's pretty stark wording, if you look at it. Right? Look what we say. We say, Nekom nikmastam avadecha, revenge, or avenge, the blood of your servants from this evil nation. So again, it's not clear historically, but it's quite possible that over time, perhaps when things, maybe when they were a little bit quieter, maybe Dafka in the midst of all of this, there was a conscious decision to remove this keta, to remove this paragraph, to remove this stanza from the Shira for fear that calling the Gentiles Uma Harishah, the evil nation, could potentially provoke them even more. You know where else we see this, by the way? Historically, there were times when Shfoch Chamascha was not said at the Pesach Seder. Why? If you look at Shfoch Chamascha, that is pretty, you wouldn't want to be a guy, right? And you say, that's a pretty serious statement. Shfoch Chamascha al Hagoyim, Asher lo yidoucha, va'al mamlachos asher b'shimcha lo karo. Very, very soon. So there were times if throughout history, again, it kind of went in cycles, when there was a conscious decision on the part of certain Jewish communities not to recite that piece. And again, truth is, in the Seder, you can get away with omitting that, because it's not, of course, it's an important part of the Seder, but it's not ma'akev. It would not prevent you from fulfilling your obligations of the night. So Rav Yaakov Sin is suggesting, that it could be that Chav Sofzor HaKachicha was part of the original composition, but was removed perhaps at certain points in time in order not to incite additional anti-Semitism. He then puts in something fascinating. He says, Bekitzer shelo nimtzu milvat habayis chasal shor kodshicha od gimel hosafos. Apparently, there's also another version of Ma'osur that actually has three more paragraphs than the one we see over here. Okay, so just the point of this, just to understand, is that first of all, it gives you an appreciation of the tefillah or of the shira when you see when it was written. This is coined by a man who lived through such a dark and desperate period of time. Yet, he tries to begin with the note of optimism. We want the geula. Things are okay, but they could be even better. And then he ends with a real-time picture as to what the Jewish community is going through. We're suffering. Our chalana ha-yeshua, salvation is too far off. You must step in and save us now, because if you don't, we don't know what is going to happen. There's a fundamental question that we have to ask when looking at Ma'osur, which is, why are we talking about all of the miracles that the Ribono Shel Olam performed on Hanukkah? Right? Remember, what is Ma'osur? It's our timeline. It begins with Egyptian bondage, old Egyptian enslavement and redemption. We then go to the building of the first Beis HaMikdash, destruction, Babylonian exile, redemption. We then go to the Purim story. We then go to the Hanukkah story. And we then go to the current predicament. So why is it that on Hanukkah, on a Yom Tov that celebrates a very specific Nes, why are we making reference to all of the other miracles that occurred before Hanukkah? And just to strengthen the question a little bit, we don't do this any other time. It's not like on Purim, right? We take the time in one of our tefillos or in one of our songs to talk about all of the miracles that happened to the Jewish people and go through them one by one in an organized shira. We certainly don't do this on the biblical Yomim Tovim. So why are we doing this on Hanukkah? So I think to answer this question, and I'm sure all of you have had this realization, but for some reason it just dawned on me last night. Hanukkah is the last overt supernatural miracle that our people has experienced. Right? Remember, since the miracle of the Pach Shemen, there has been no other supernatural miracles. Have there been miracles? Plenty of miracles. But the miracles that we have observed since the Hanukkah story have all been cloaked in Teva. Have all been cloaked in nature. Hanukkah is amazing because it represents the last, divine display of supernatural activity on behalf of the Jewish people. Now, when we think about miracles, we often assume that the point of a miracle is to provide immediate salvation. And of course, that is true. So if we look at the Pach Shemen, right, the Hashmonaim wanted to come in, wanted to go ahead and light the menorah, couldn't find oil, only one jug of oil, and so the miracle allowed for them to go ahead and light the menorah for 8 days until they could replenish their source. So yes, miracles on one level serve a very utilitarian purpose. There's a problem, there's a need, we're stuck, miracle comes to the rescue. But there's a deeper level to miracles. A miracle is a mechayev. Now, what does that mean? Literally translated, a miracle obligates me. Now, what does that mean? If the Ribono Shel Olam has performed a miracle for me, which means if God has actively chosen to either suspend or break His own laws of nature, then it must mean that my life, my existence, is worth something. The Ribono Shel Olam doesn't do miracles just simply for the sake of doing miracles. He only does a miracle because the recipient of that miracle has something additional to give. The miracle comes to rectify an immediate situation because God needs to extricate the individuals or nation from their current predicament, because the individuals, nation, have something more that they must do and that they must accomplish. In fact, interestingly enough, how do we begin our morning every day? If you take a look at number 12, so the Mishnah Berurah writes, Tov lomar tekef bekumo, mo da'ani lifonecha, melechai vekayom, shechazarta binishmasi, bechem lorabo emunasecha. So let's look at this phrase for just a moment. Moda ani lefanecha. Literally, I admit, or I could also, moda can either mean I admit or I thank. Either one, I admit or I thank before you, God. Melechai v'chayim, the living eternal God. Shechzarta b'nishmasi. You've given me back my soul. Bechemla. And you've done it how? With mercy, with compassion. Rabba emunasecha. And abundant or great is your faith. So the question becomes, faith in what? When we say to God, Rabba emunasecha, that your faith is great, faith in what? The answer is, faith in me. Ribono Shel Olam, if you have chosen to give me back my neshama, it means, Rabba emunasecha, that you must have abundant faith in me, that I have something to do, that I have something to accomplish, that I have something that is uniquely me, that I must contribute to my friends, to my family, to my community, to my people, to mankind. That's Rabba Emunasecha. The fact that man opens his eyes in the morning is the greatest vote of confidence from the Ribono Shel Olam. Because if I had nothing to accomplish, God doesn't want people wasting space on His earth. So if I have nothing to accomplish, the Ribono Shel Olam could just as easily keep that neshama with him in Shamayim. Moda'ani, Ribono Shel Olam, I thank you. What do I thank you for? For allowing me to start my day with this incredible boost of divine confidence. Rabba Emunasecha, you have so much faith in me that you have chosen to restore my neshama. I thank you, Ribono Shel Olam, for demonstrating that you have all that faith in me. So now watch this. Hanukkah, as we just said before, is the last miracle that occurs before the Golos that has spanned thousands of years, that reaches to this very day, began. Hanukkah represents the last time that the Ribono Shel Olam revealed Himself to our people in a supernatural fashion. And from Hanukkah and on, begins a downward spiral that we are still experiencing to this day. Hopefully now we're not on the downward end of it anymore. Hopefully now we're in the upsurge. But we are still in that galus that essentially began immediately after Hanukkah. So perhaps we could suggest that the whole point of Ma'os Tzur is to create a context. Because what is the greatest danger of this elongated galus? What is the greatest danger of this post-Hanukkah diaspora experience? Giving up. Yeyush. Right? Remember, listen to the tone. Listen to the tone in the last stanza again of Ma'oz Tzur. Right? That was we'll call it 800 years ago. Right? A little bit less. Right? That was, we'll call it 700 years ago. That was the tone then. And for 700 years, the Jew had to go through those type of experiences and worse. So now, for thousands of years, we live in the darkness of this diaspora. The greatest existential threat is Yeyush. That man will simply give up, throw his hands in the air and say, you know what? I cannot do this anymore. So what does Ma'oz Tzur do? Ma'oz Tzur creates a context. What's the context? Look at everything the Ribono Shel Olam has done for us. He took us out of Egypt when we were suffering there. He brought us to the land of Israel. And even though we didn't behave when we first got there, he destroyed our first temple, and he took us to Bavel, we came back from Bavel. And even when we were in foreign lands and we faced existential threats like we did by Purim, still the Ribono Shel Olam came to our aid. And even in Eretz Yisrael, when all looked lost, the Ribono Shel Olam came to our aid. So how does all of this help us? Because God would not have invested all of this time, resources, and divine energy into a people who had no future. The whole point of recalling all of these miracles on Hanukkah is because Mordechai, the composer, understood that Hanukkah is a very severe turning point for the Jewish people. We don't think about this because we get pretty wrapped up in the miracle. What about the morning after the miracle? Right, the morning after, when then we began our steady decline, which we are currently experiencing to this day, how does the Jew weather thousands of years of persecution, of suffering, of darkness, of difficulty? And the answer can only be found when you look at the continuum of Jewish history. When you see all that the Ribono Shel Olam has done for us. Now remember, those past things don't alleviate our suffering right now. But what those past things remind us of is that God has heavily invested in the Jewish people. And if God has invested in us, He is not going to let us falter. He's not going to simply let us wither away, because otherwise, what was the point of all of those salvations? What was the point of all of those miracles? What was the point of all of that divine involvement? So even when life looks difficult, and even when life looks bleak, and even when we say to ourselves, Archal lanu ha-Yeshua, we can't wait anymore for salvation, just hold on. Because God has invested in us. Rabba emunasecha. The greatest boost to the spiritual confidence of the Jew is looking in the lens of Jewish history. If you look at all that has happened in our past, it is clear that the Ribono Shel Olam has a future, a glorious future in store for us. And that has to be our beacon, and that has to be our strength, even in the difficulties of Galus. Hanukkah, because it is the last miracle before the Galus to which we are experiencing to this day, must give the message of the totality of the Jewish experience. And that message is conveyed in Ma'oz Tzur. So in six short stanzas, we see the entire continuum of Jewish history. We are reminded, Rabba Emunasecha, that the Ribono Shel Olam has invested in us. That God has done everything He has done up until now, which is the greatest sign that we have something to accomplish. Because otherwise, all of those miracles were unnecessary. Now we could go back and answer our Rav Hirsch. If you remember, again, we spoke a little while ago about the idea. Rav Hirsch, remember, how did he define Nes? How did he, what? Right? A banner, a sign, something that you are to look to and to gain chizuk, and to gain some type of eternal message. Now we understand why Neros Chanukah are the Nes of the Jewish people. Right? The Neros Chanukah. Ultimately, why do we look to them as something? Why do we look to them as a sign? Why do we look to them as a banner? Why do they contain an eternal importance, perhaps more so than anything else? Because the Neros Chanukah was the last tangible reminder that God is investing in us. The Neros Chanukah were the last tangible reminder that the Ribono Shel Olam believes in us. So what Rav Hirsch was trying to say is that even throughout the darkness of the diaspora, even through the turbulence of the Jewish people, there is one symbol that must remain front and center in the mind's eye of the Jew, and that is the menorah. Remember those candles, and when you remember the candles, you can remember your Maos Tzur, and you remember everything that came before all of those candles, and you're going to remember how heavily vested HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in our destiny, and that is the ultimate assurance, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu has invested so much in us, it is clear that we have a bright and brilliant future. And even though sometimes it feels so out of reach, sometimes on a personal level, sometimes on a national level, we always have in our mind's eye that menorah. And that reminds us that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has so heavily invested in us in the past, it is clear that He has plans for a glorious future. All right, we'll stop over here. How come? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know also, again, what it could very well be. It probably points to the fact that this Mordechai was within the Ashkenazi communities. You want to say, how did the Sephardim get this message?
Maybe it was taken out of their support.
Right, that could be also. That could be also. Although the Jews of the Sephardic lands, it could be.
Could be.
That's right, to make up for the lack of Maos Tzur.